Welcome to Dollars and Cents, Creating Your Fulfilled Life with Nicole Romito from Private Vista. In this podcast, we draw from years of experience as well as guest specialists to help you create the life you imagine. Join us in this journey as we enlighten and empower you to align your lifestyle to help you achieve your goals with a clear picture of your future. Now, let's get to the show.
And welcome to the Dollars and Cents podcast with your host, Nicole Romito. Nicole, another dated, timely podcast. My, you're boldly venturing where few dare to go in the podcast world here.
Oh, you know me. I always like to do the road less followed or the path less chosen, whatever that I think Scott Fitzgerald's quote is. But we're here today. I'm super excited. We've talked a little bit about, well, the equity side and how to maybe handle or things to think about with the continual high level of volatility we're experiencing. So today, my guest and I are going to discuss the fixed income or bond side of the portfolio.
Ooh, nice. Yeah. Nice.
I agree. I think the bond market does not get the amount of love that it deserves. You know, it's been certainly more on the forefront of investors and I know our clients' minds just because of all the interest rates going up and down. But I kind of feel like in general, the equities get all the press. So I'm very happy to welcome in Bill Campbell today in studio. Hi, Bill. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. My pleasure. So before we, I guess for our listeners, I want to give you a little bit of background on my guest today. As I mentioned, Bill Campbell is in studio with me. He is a portfolio manager with a firm called Double Line. He's been with them since 2013. And his current role is he is the portfolio manager for their global bond strategy and is a permanent member of the Fixed Income Asset Allocation Committee. I've got to imagine the talks have been very lively in those committee meetings lately. In addition, he covers developed markets, Central and Eastern Europe, Middle East and Africa, and China. Prior to joining Double Line, he worked for a variety of well-known firms in our industry, Paradigm Global Investors, Nuveen, and John Hancock Financial. His education background, he has a BS in business, economics, and international business, as well as a BA in English from Pennsylvania State University, holds an MA in mathematics with a focus in mathematical finance from Boston University. So you certainly have the education and then real life experience of navigating the world of bonds. Bill, I just shared a little bit about you professionally. Would you mind sharing a little bit personally, maybe about your family and what you enjoy doing when you are not globetrotting around the world looking at fixed income investments?
Well, sure. I'm lucky enough to reside in Los Angeles, which is an advantage because I've rediscovered my passion for biking, both road biking and mountain biking. So we have some of the most beautiful mountain trails, I think, in the United States, if not on the globe, all within driving distance around me. We're right on the coast. So
It's gotta be beautiful.
Some of the most stunning road biking, adventures. So I have two kids, age 7 and 9, and both I am convinced you put a 1 in front of those ages, that seems to be, you know, how quickly they grow up. It, time flies, but
yeah, the blink of an eye.
Yeah. And, between those two passions, and I gave the passions in the reverse order, but,
Well, I'd have to guess your kids probably aren't going to listen to this podcast or do you have mandatory listening?
My daughter, 7-year-old might.
I love that. Okay.
Yeah, she's on it.
Oh my gosh. And have you introduced your kids? Are they biking with you at all?
Yeah, that we do. I'm just because they're younger, we'll do, just bike trails, which are next to the Los Angeles now is starting to try to make an attempt at putting in public transportation. So we're starting to, they have bike trails next to, some of the brand new expo lines or the subway, above ground subway lines that they're putting in. So We'll do that with them. I took them to a trail once, and it within, I think, about 200 yards, they realized that an uphill gradient wasn't for them.
Oh, no.
It was gradual, too, but yeah.
Not to them, right? Yeah. They're a little closer to the ground, so maybe it looked a little steeper from their vantage point.
Oh, yeah. No, they dismounted pretty quickly. But it was cute. Like, you know, we're more focused on my son plays flag football. My daughter is currently on cheer squad. And
nice.
That keeps between that and birthday parties, that keeps the weekends pretty full.
Yeah, pretty action packed there.
Yeah, I think so. And
I would say so. So, yeah. All right. Well, great. Well, thanks for sharing. I know our listeners always appreciate knowing a little bit personally about my guests. So appreciate that. I mean, with that, you know, just like much like you said, your 7 and 9-year-olds were like, whoa, this is too steep, Dad. I'm getting off here. I think a lot of investors have been feeling that way as well. So I'm going to use that as a loose segue to get to our topic for the day. You know, as I mentioned to our listeners, we're going to be solely focused on the fixed income. Many people refer to it as the bond world, you know, could mean that's very generic terms, but that's the kind of part of the investment pond we're going to be swimming in today. You know, Bill, when we first started talking, we've had Liberation Day come and go. We certainly saw a lot of fallout and volatility in all areas of the market. And then we've now are working through the 90-day pause. So I believe everything's supposed to be buttoned up by July 9th. So why don't we start there? Yeah, I see you shaking your head. It was a little tongue in cheek on my part, but why don't you, let's kind of start off there. Oh, and before we start the conversation, listeners, just so you know, because things are moving so quickly, Bill and I are talking on May 15th. So we do want to intentionally let you know what day we're talking about in case, because this will be released at least a couple weeks out. And the one thing Bill and I are highly confident in is probably many, if not all things, will be different than the set of facts and circumstances we're working from today. So with that, Bill, why don't you kind of kick us off on like the whole fun tea world of tariffs?
Sure. Yeah. So I think the real question is where to begin. I mean, so much has happened over the past, it's been a little under a month and a half since we really had the Liberation Day tariffs put on. And one thing I tried to do when at the start of this, and we got into, you know, the announcement of all of the reciprocal tariffs was to, you know, kind of understand what is the philosophy or what is the framework for the administration in their policy actions and what are they trying to achieve. And at the start of this, and Nicole, we had discussed it, thinking about several landing points, is the idea merely to raise revenue, tariffs being a new revenue line item in the budget to get through a more stimulative budget? Was it to make trade more of a fair and balanced playing field? Was it to bring manufacturing back to the United States? Was it to just de-link and ring fence China? Is it a combination of all of those? And we luckily have just in the past several weeks gone through the IMF meetings and World Bank meetings in Washington, D.C., where not only U.S. policymakers, but global policymakers are invited to Washington to, you know, sit down and discuss, you know, the current state of affairs around the globe. Then we here in Los Angeles had the Milken Conference and, you know, Scott Bessent was in attendance along with other former and current administration officials. And it's given me an opportunity to meet and listen to perspectives as to, you know, what's happening. And what I was really able to kind of take away from that is I do think that are some broader objectives that, you know, the administration is trying to achieve. One, I think there is a national security concern about the U.S.'s ability, both from an industrial base standpoint, if there was ever a major geopolitical issue, to have the production capacity to, you know, be able to support a defense or, you know, an offensive military effort. And I think when we look at the sector level tariffs on autos, which, you know, yes, there are some carve outs for the friendshoring for auto parts for Canada and Mexico, but for the most part, the auto tariffs, you know, are basically in place. And I think that you can kind of wrap into, you know, this concern. You're seeing steel and aluminum, you know, the Section 232 tariffs went through and those exist. And I think that also, you know, is in furtherance of that policy effort. And then COVID kind of also illuminated other structural deficits that we had around pharmaceuticals, you know, health, you know, what we used to call PPE. But, you know, as far as the healthcare, you know, system, I think the, you know, there is going to be a sectoral focus, you know, to trying to make sure that, you know, maybe it's not 100% U.S., you know, not 100%, you know, U.S. capacity in each of those sectors, but at least, you know, a much larger, you know, grow out of the U.S. manufacturing capacity in those sectors. And then the final one being semiconductors. That was, you know, those tariffs and that objective kind of made sense. And, you know, we're still expecting some more action, you know, around healthcare. You know, we'll see kind of how the semiconductor, you know, play the semiconductor tariff and trade policy plays out. And, you know, I think it's wholly reasonable for us to kind of continue to expect some policy action, you know, on that side, but that didn't really describe the reciprocal tariff regime. So there, when I was having, you know, conversations, the best I can tease out is there is a concern that, and, you know, maybe, and I do think there's some valid points in this, that the goal is not to cut trade off completely. The goal is what you hear about is balanced trade and normalized trade, and they want fair and reciprocal trade. So I think the idea that they are really shooting for there is there's been a view that there's a hollowing out of the American middle class. Inequality has picked up and trade, you know, has been a big portion of that. Now, free traders will say, well, look, the law of comparative advantage would suggest that cheap labor, you know, elsewhere around the globe would just, you know, basically naturally provide that this is the direction that, you know, we were supposed to, that the globe, the U.S. was supposed to go anyway. And by, you know, shipping some of, you know, the goods manufacturing capacity offshore, it freed up, you know, the American workforce to become a little bit more educated, to move more to the services sector. And, you know, get higher value added jobs in the services sector, which we have. And if you look, it's really a goods trade deficit, you know, that we have. The services that we export, we mostly export, you know, services to the globe. And the, you know, there is a decent, you know, argument around the idea that the transition, the U.S. moving from, you know, goods producing economy to a services producing economy, you know, has been a good thing. And the pushback that I got from, you know, the people that I met with was, well, then how do you explain, you know, a lot of the inequality? And their argument is a lot of the gains that were made on the good side was due to subsidization of good sectors, especially by China, but also by other countries. And that China, you know, suppressed natural consumption and subsidized investment. And because it's not, you know, a democratic free market society, the, you know, gains that were made, you know, in the growth of their industrial base allowed them then to start taking that wealth that was created and then purchase U.S. assets, but also purchase U.S. IP as you had more means of production come in. And in that way, you know, again, as it was described, there's almost been a theft of both American wealth and American IP unfairly to these nations that, you know, had been providing, you know, subsidies. And the way to address that is place a tariff to offset those subsidies and encourage, you know, when on a fair playing field, economic capacity to come back to the United States. And in the meantime, we'll be, you know, collecting revenue that will be then helping us to potentially reduce the deficit, which we can get. That's a whole nother discussion. But in the meantime, if you do implement the tariffs, that you will then be able to have a normalization of these imbalances that trade. When we think about trade, you know, the argument is we're not, the US is not asking for trade to go to zero. On the goods side, we roughly import approximately $3 trillion, you know, worth of foreign goods, but, you know, we export $2 trillion. So there's a trillion, you know, mismatch that needs to be adjusted for. And it's not all that, you know, we're just going to import less. Maybe we import less, but then we also bring a little bit more production back into the U.S. and export some. So a balancing, it doesn't all have to be in one direction, I guess is my point. It's just a balancing, you know, of that. And
is the goal, yeah, Bill, to get as close to zero as possible? Like, would that be the
on
ideal?
On a trade balance, where I think the administration, their landing point would be they would like to see imports equaling exports, that because then they would view that as, you know, much more of a fair and reciprocal, right, you know, trading environment. Now, I think after hearing that explanation, I could kind of see where the administration is coming from.
Okay.
You know, and I think that, you know, some of those goals, you know, do seem reasonable. The problem is these imbalances have built up over the past 30 years.
Yeah.
And we have, you know, deep interlinked supply chains around the globe that, you know, have that are in existence due to the current architecture of, you know, the global supply chain framework. The attempt to try to change that in 1 month or, you know, even 3 months, yeah, I think is where the real shock, you know, came. And I think the market has really forced the administration to both rethink the implementation strategy and also to, you know, just, I think they were trying to see how much they could get away with in the near term, but, you know, maybe it has to elongate, you know,
right.
And we need to kind of see where these contours, new policy are going to go in order to, I still think that those objectives that I laid out are where they are trying to go. So to just kind of, you know, maybe bring this all around, I know I've kind of gone into a bit of detail here, but I do think the sectoral tariffs, you know, we're going to see more of those. There's going to be more targeting on those as, you know, my first point. I would think that, you know, even though we have 90-day delays on, you know, a lot of these very high tariffs, I think that unless there's a major issue that arises, a new issue that arises in the near term, I could see a lot of these delays getting extended. And we also know that any trade agreement, you know, takes years to really put together. And when you really start going through the detail of, you know, every single line item that has to come into the country and, you know, what are the exact agreements, when we look at the trade, I would call it an outline that we got with the UK, this agreement, mm-hmm, in principle. Very, very broad-based, you know, measures on keeping the auto Section 232 with, you know, maybe some carve-outs. And I think that there's probably going to be, you know, some stumbling blocks along the way as we really start to see these, you know, the details of these agreements hammered out. But I would be surprised if we saw a return to the extreme tariffs that Liberation Day, you know, had announced, because I don't think the markets can handle it. And I also don't think the economy can handle it. You know, remember coming into this year, we were at all-time highs in equity markets. We, yeah, you know, had the idea that, you know, it was U.S. exceptionalism. I think we've had a lot of wealth that now has, you know, taken a hit, and we're started to see margins get squeezed at corporations. And I think that the strength of the labor market that we have seen was underpinned by the very high level of margins that we were coming into this year with. And with the erosion that we're seeing, I think, you know, it's becoming more difficult for the U.S. to be able to sustain additional aggressive tariff action that can have negative economic and financial consequences on, you know, on companies.
Yeah, absolutely. And then just, it's just going to filter down then to the end consumer as well.
As a consumer, like, so once you start becoming in fear of your job, like, so there's the idea of the increase in savings post COVID, you know, gave the consumer a lot of cushion and that we had a lot of wealth. These are very hard arguments to say when that wealth is, you know, going to be fully spent. I've seen all sorts of different ways to estimate where wealth is, but what I can say is that if consumers start fearing for the outlook for their job, they're going to pull back on spending. Right. And add on top of that, even though it's a marginal price increase at this point, some of it's, there's a question of how much of the current baseline tariffs are going to be passed through.
Right.
Well, some of it's going to be passed through. Companies are going to see how much pass through
they can pass through, right?
How much they can get away with.
Exactly.
And, you know, there's another little wrinkle in this that, you know, the dollar depreciating, you know, over 10% in like the past month,
right,
actually has had the negative impact that it's doubling the size of the tariff impact. Because if you are importing goods and you put a 10% tax, consumption tax, but a tariff on that good, but then the dollar is depreciated by 10%. So now you have another 10% that you need to pay on top of it.
Right.
You know, that you're, there's a lot of price impact that is potentially, you know, that can be felt. So I think that the from the standpoint of the consumer can get, I think the consumer can start to retrench, both due to, you know, the uncertainty about the outlook, you know, for their jobs, but also as things become more expensive, even, you know, not having 100% certainty on how much savings cushion they have left. It doesn't matter. Those other two factors will cause a bit of a retrenchment of the consumer. And as you know, then that increases sales and revenues, squeezes margins more, and then you start getting into a question of when does that loop start to really feed back into layoffs picking up. And we already are starting to see several of the large corporations, you know, in these earnings calls are starting to announce that they're thinking about anticipated layoffs in the future. I think the pause right now, I would assume, is the base case, and that we, yes, the sectoral tariffs for national security reasons would rise, but can still come. But if you try to do a blanket increase in tariffs from here, I don't know if the economy, the jobs market, the consumer can, you know, withstand another large shock like that. And
yeah,
I think the administration's aware
through that again.
Absolutely. And I think Scott Bessent is highly, I'm glad to see Scott Bessent taking the reins of what the administration's doing, because he has a deep understanding of markets, economics. I mean, I think we have, you know, luckily somebody in the Treasury who understands both sides of that coin, both financial markets and the plumbing, as well as economics and the interlinkages of the two. And I think he's, from what I've seen so far, taking a much more reasonable approach to things. And I think potentially trying to address those imbalances that I talked about, just in, you know, a little bit more measured manner.
Yeah, which, I mean, it just, it would be that would be the logical approach to doing something like this. So we shall see. I mean, one of the things we've talked about, and then even you said too, we're in this 90-day pause, but, you know, will it be another extension, or will there, you know, just be multiple extensions and it'll end up taking, you know, over time? How can you, since we're in this wait and see time period, how can people, and I know we're not making recommendations or anything like that, but what are some of the things to think about as you're looking on the bond or fixed income side for investors' portfolios?
Right. So the tariffs, I think there's one thing that they absolutely have done. They've increased policy uncertainty around the United States. The other big element to this is, where are we going with debt and deficits? And when we look at the bill that is now being pushed through the House, it still remains extremely deficit expansionary. But by rolling out, you know, the TCJA tax cuts, they basically are trying to, and what the through an accounting trick, they have adjusted what, you know, they said, you know, current law versus current policy for the TCJA tax cuts. They've made the adjustment from current law to current policy. And it sounds kind of like a small nuance. What's the big deal there? By making that legal verbiage change, they no longer need to account for the $4 trillion that extending the TCJA permanently puts back into the budget. So when we look at the potential new revenue line items, you know, the first was supposed to be tariffs. And the tariffs, you know, have started at a very high level, but they are coming down. So, you know, the anticipated revenue gain from tariffs is getting lower and lower. And then the other one was the expenditure cuts that were going to come out of DOGE and Elon Musk's cost saving effort. And the estimates there have also been coming lower and lower. So when we take a step back and look at the overall contours of budget that's being put forward, we don't find it to be fiscally austere in any means. I think what the administration is really going for here is they're making a bet that they can lift growth up and grow out of the current deficit between expenditures and revenues. And the idea is if growth goes up, eventually revenues will grow up. And they want to, that's really, I think, the idea of like, how can you ration, when you ask, how can you rationalize the budget that they're putting forward?
Right.
They're saying, well, the growth estimates need to be brought up, and then that should start to bring revenues and expenditures in line. We remain more skeptical on that piece of it. And so the second risk that we see is the deficit remains wide. And, you know, if we do have a growth shock to the downside or even a further slowdown, which it appears like we are going to be experiencing slower growth in the near term, that's only going to, you know, add to these deficit concerns. And as you run a deficit, the only way to pay for it is to borrow. So that's going to increase the Treasury's need to issue government bonds. And it's our view that both the policy uncertainty from tariffs and also the policy uncertainty regarding the Fed and who's going to be the new Fed governor and independence there. And then the, you know, issues around the deficit are going to put more pressure on treasuries, both from the supply side, the Treasury needs to issue more in order to pay for the deficit, but also from the demand side, that holding on to long-term U.S. assets, even U.S. government assets, given the increased policy uncertainties, may not be as optimal. Now, that being said, we think in the short to medium term that even with a debt to GDP around 100%, there's still room to run. The Fed is still going to maintain control of the yield curve. So for us, when we're thinking about, you know, our allocation to what spot on the yield curve or at what point of the debt market do we want to be loaning to? We're going much more short term. We're favoring the short term as we think yields in the long term, you know, are going to be under pressure. And they're going to be under structural pressure, which is bringing us to make most of our investments what I would call in the short to medium term, the interest rate curve. But, you know, from the front end out to about, you know, the 7 year.
Okay, that's what I was just going to ask. What do you consider short to medium term? So up to about 7 years?
Out to about the 7 year point is really kind of where we're finding a lot of opportunities. We also think that the rally on, as you said, May 15th, you know, that we've seen, it's been ferocious. It's been sharp. And for the equity investors, it looks like, you know, now we went from 2 weeks ago near-term lows to we're almost retracing, and we might in another week or two be pushing to highs. We have retraced in spreads, which follow equities basically. Our spreads are basically like yields, but they've been ratcheting in. So as yields and spreads come down, price goes up. But they've retraced to the point where they were pre-Liberation Day. So the sell-off that happened has now completely been brought out in the past couple of weeks. And it's hard for us at this point to get too excited about the outlook. The economic outlook, I think, still remains uncertain, as I laid out at the beginning.
Right.
So we're finding a lot of interesting investments, again, in high quality structured products, in high quality companies, in that, you know, front end to the belly, you know, where we can start, we can continue to, you know, deploy capital, be very comfortable that, you know, we're going to receive interest and principal back. And, you know, we're targeting five, depending on your strategy, you can get 5 to 7, maybe even a little bit higher if you can take a little bit more risk. Those would be kind of the near-term target returns. But again, if you can hold those assets for the life for the next, let's call it 5 years or 3 to 5 years, we think it's going to provide a much smoother ride for investors, especially for, we still have, you know, another 3.5 years of this policy uncertainty in this administration. So I think the, you know, discussion about ultimately where we end up, I think it's very bimodal. Maybe the administration pulls a rabbit out of the hat and, you know, they get a lot of growth and everything works out well, but maybe they don't. And while we have this high level of uncertainty, I do think investors should be really thinking about taking advantage of high quality fixed income in their portfolios.
Couldn't agree more. And I think our longtime listeners know, you know, here at Private Vista, we believe in asset allocation, diversification. Frankly, a lot of our clients, as we've been talking to them, you know, between Inauguration Day and, you know, today, if you will, so the first 5.5 months of the year, if you will, a lot of clients were like, Nicole, don't tell me. I don't even want to, I haven't logged in. I don't want to know. But at given points of times, they were like up a few points, they were even, they were down. And regardless, when I said, you know what, Bill, I'm not going to listen to you. And I tell them the number, they're like, oh, this is holding up much better than I thought. And so it's just understanding that, I mean, there certainly is a lot of talk, I would say the last several years about bonds and the, right, the Fed funds rate and mortgage rates. So I feel like your part of the investment world certainly has been more prominent in the news cycle, but I don't know that clients really are, we're hearing about the interest rate and the yield curve, but really not total return on that side. So it certainly has been, you know, as it's intended, kind of the ballast of helping hold up the portfolio when the other parts of the portfolio are down at any given time. So
that is the function, right. You know, I think of fixed income in the portfolios, and especially when, you know, uncertainty increases, I think, you know, the probably a simple heuristic for your end investors, as uncertainty increases, the high quality fixed income provides less volatility and a little bit more, you know, certainty of income streams in your portfolio.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. And even if the value of a bond or a stock, the underlying value may be down on paper, you're still getting your interest payment in the case of a bond or your dividend payment in the case of a stock.
That's right. Depending on where the investor is also in their, you know, life cycle. It becomes an invaluable piece of kind of the overall, you know, investment mix.
No, I was just going to say, as you progress through the life cycle and you go from accumulating to decumulating, it's not uncommon to see your mindset shift, to, hey, I've worked hard for this and I've got to protect what I have. Because, absolutely, you know, I'm no longer adding to it. I'm actually at the point where I've turned that into my paycheck or my income stream to be able to live life how I want to. And you see a whole, generally speaking, a different mindset of how people are thinking about how much risk they're willing to take on with the overall portfolio.
Absolutely. So maybe if we, you know, can switch, you know, back to macro for a second.
Yeah, that would be great. I was going to say, I mean, Bill, we could probably have a 20-part series with you on. This time has just flown by. I hope our listeners feel the same way. But yeah, why don't we take maybe, if I'd love to get like a macro switch, if it's possible. Are we able to do that maybe in like 3 to 5 minutes or so?
Sure. Do you want to discuss the U.S. dollar? Because I think there's some interesting things happening in currency and global markets.
That was actually one of the topics I had. We've hit everything. And I do think there is a lot of talk about, as you noted, the dollar, as you know, we've seen a devaluation of about 10% here recently. There's the talk of, will the dollar continue to be the world currency, you know, and things like that. So I think that would be a great topic to wrap up on.
Fantastic. I think in order to just frame the conversation quickly, it always helps to think about initial conditions. And coming into this year, things flipped on a dime. Coming into this year, you know, there was the idea that U.S. exceptionalism would continue. The U.S. prior to this year, you know, has always been thought of, especially across developed markets, as having higher nominal growth, as being a place where multinational corporations are, where you have high potential earnings growth, and then you're rewarded by also high multiples. And we were at very high valuations across all, risk assets across the board, but people were willing to continue to try to buy into the United States because this is where, you know, the growth engine was seen to be. Now, additional to that is we had seen the dollar, you know, continue to steadily appreciate and like maintain its value into this year. So international investors, not only have they been pouring their savings that, you know, they've earned from trade and elsewhere into U.S. assets and U.S., fixed income and direct investment, whether, you know, building out a new plant or other types of investment that companies make, a lot of the assets were being held unhedged. When we look at the hedge ratios, cost of hedging as an international, especially from many of the Asian countries, you're looking at, you know, cost of hedging like somewhere in some countries around a little under 5%. And so if you have to take 5% off of your investment every year, that's costly.
Yeah, that adds up.
It does. And so the hedge ratios, the percentage of the portfolio that's, been hedged was also coming into this year very low. So we had two things happen. One, the Trump administration surprised to the downside as far as, you know, sequencing tariffs first and growth at the back and lowered those growth expectations. And then secondly, you had, a situation where when the dollar started coming off, it reflexively made people have to, international investors, have to start increasing those hedge ratios aggressively, because now the cost is worth it because the outlook, for the U.S. dollar, became more uncertain. We have those two things hit very quickly. And over the course of basically 2 months, we saw the dollar aggressively depreciate. If you just look on the broad dollar, the DXY index went from about 110 to where we're at about 100 today. But hedge ratios have been, brought back up. And the evidence for large scale selling of U.S. assets and reallocating everywhere else, it's still hard to find. Now, again, it's May 15th. We may start to see, going forward, larger reallocations out of the U.S. But at least as of today, it looks like, yes, there was some repatriation, but that was relatively small. The majority of the story, from what I can tell, is the upping of these hedging portfolios that many institutional investors or large pension funds, large investment funds, had against U.S. assets. So the big question of, is the dollar going to lose its reserve currency status? I remain skeptical on the dollar all of a sudden losing the crown, and then the new crown is given either to the euro or, to the Chinese yuan. I think that is probably more likely, and what we're likely to see more is, as trade rebalances, we're going to see central banks around the world, and they've already started this, increase the memorandum of understanding that they have between each other to remove the dollar from settlement between bilateral trade between those two countries. And maybe to just concretely say that in an example, why is it that the US dollar should be the medium of exchange of for trade between Australia and Singapore? Why can't Australia and Singapore just exchange Australian dollars for Singaporean dollars? And because there's a natural trade flow between the two, and both of those countries run fairly austere fiscal budgets, they have decent economies, that those can be trusted currencies. And actually, in fact, we have been seeing an increase of global central banks saying, let's intermediate trade bilaterally. Okay. And that's been decreasing on the margin.
I was just going to say, what kind of impact? I mean, it's probably, it sounds like it's just starting out. So I was going to ask, to the extent of what impact is that having?
Well, from what we can tell so far, if this has been gradually unfolding over the past 5 years or maybe just a little bit longer, but we've seen on the margin the percentage of U.S. dollars held as reserve currency managers' portfolios steadily decrease about 5%. It's been an up and down pattern. I think that that gradual decrease is still likely. Now, the reason why I say it's not going to completely disappear is when you start to get to, you know, more of the emerging market economies or economies that maybe you're less or countries that you're less comfortable with, trade with China. You know, I know we are starting to see more yuan settlement, but maybe not everybody is comfortable with yuan settlement. Or if you go into emerging market countries where there's a lot more volatility, dollar still remains at the base of the global financial system. It still is accepted pretty much as currency for trade everywhere. And again, first mover advantage. Think that it's going to remain overweight compared to our percentage of the global economic GDP pie. So whereas we stand about a quarter of overall of the total global GDP, I think probably fair to assume that dollar assets and reserve currency reserve currency baskets would probably be at least double that.
So I feel like I said, I could sit here and listen to you or talk with you for the duration of the day. What I'm hearing is just like I think you talked about in an earlier topic is people or manufacturing or if they're trying to get more back to the U.S., and that was more along the vein of national security, that if the dollar, people are starting to shift away or thinking about it, both of those are going to be gradual and over time. So we're not going to, right, we're not flipping the switch. And then even by the end of this year, which is still 6 months away and is not a meaningful part of time, but we're not thinking, oh, we're going to go away from the dollar and boom at the end of the year. It's just too, I think, intricated and involved in so many different layers of the world's transactions and economies that it is going to be kind of a, if it happens, it'll be a slow and steady drift away from that.
I believe that there will be a slow and steady drift in that. Just quickly, the other piece of that is all the new investment as you get new money. I do think that less is going to be coming into the United States and more is going to be focused on being deployed locally. So countries that run trade surpluses are going to be looking at more local investment. Okay. Europe is also going to be an interesting destination, but
which one was that?
Europe, I think, is going to be an interesting destination with, you know, now all the renewed defense spending, infrastructure spending that has to happen. So one thing that U.S. investors, for a long time, we've had the exorbitant privilege of having of enjoying U.S. exceptionalism, of being the place of where capital has wanted to find its home. Yeah. Exactly. So that's kept the cost of capital low. It's deployed capital aggressively back into our markets, allowed for stronger growth, and allowed for strong earnings. I think going forward, that may be chipped away a little bit. And that cycle, as capital is redeployed in international markets, such as in Europe, in Japan, Australia, New Zealand, in like these developed markets, I think that you can make an argument there's becoming more and more interesting. There are going to be more and more interesting investment opportunities abroad over the next, let's call it 5 to 10 years, as this trend towards less of a dollar-based system, but more of a multipolar system of many countries now interacting with each other in their own best interests. Yeah. I think that there's going to be a lot of opportunities to be had. And I think investors now should be really starting to open their mindset to, thinking about adding, if you don't have it already, international allocation to your portfolios. And if you want to do it in, you know, a little less volatile way, maybe the way to baby step into it is not international equities, but do international fixed income.
Yeah. Well, you took the words right out of my mouth. What I'm hearing is, you know, diversification is going to become even more important. And, you know, they have all the studies showing is at least in the US, I haven't seen him for outside, but we tend to have a very home country bias in our investment portfolio. So I would agree with that. It's we're not suggesting timing the market or anything like that, but if you have had more of a home country bias, this might be an ideal time to start to branch out if you know you're doing this on your own. And the other thing I would, and this is not a shameless plug for Bill, but certainly in the fixed income world, having a manager who is actively, I'm going to say, minding the shop, in my opinion, is more important than ever, because this is a very fluid world we live in. And the bond markets can and do work differently than the equity markets, and especially for where Bill runs around in, which is on the international side. So thank you so much, Bill. I know you have so much more to share, but I really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy day to talk with me and share a little bit of your insights and thoughts with our listeners.
Nicole, thank you for having me. My
pleasure.
I appreciate your time.
You know what, I Nicole, you could keep this conversation going.
I know.
You really could. I've been sitting here listening to it the entire time.
Well, that's good.
And I'm resisting the urge to jump into this conversation and continue it on.
Well, thank you. Yeah, well, we could do part two.
I was just going to say, I think you have successfully talked yourself into part two, Bill. So good job.
Yeah, thank you.
It was great, Bill. You have an ability to express clearly some of the complex issues that people are looking at and having to should be evaluating and thinking about.
Well, and we're
in the current investment environment.
Yeah, I mean, we do a lot of thinking here, and I think, you know, it sometimes, I know I can sometimes be long-winded, but I think it sometimes helps, like, once we've struggled for days and weeks to try to figure out, like, what is going on? What are these guys doing? You know, at least, you know, I think it's lazy to just say, oh, they're nuts, and, you know, they're going to do, it's just like they're all shooting from the hip, because you know, that what good does that do? But if you, I think, understand, well, I think these are the general principles that they're trying to, or these are the issues they're trying to fix, or these are the general principles that they're trying to use. Mm-hmm. Whether I agree with the policy implementation or not, I can understand that and have a view on maybe where things are going, maybe indirectly. Yeah. I think this administration they need somebody who can clearly articulate, because that what I got was from a lot of meetings, a lot of back and forth, teasing things out, writing things out myself. Yep. So I don't know.
My only response to you on that, Bill and Nicole, is that, you know, we're in this world where, you know, an 8-second video, 10-second videos are what command our attention. And the truth is that we're dealing with issues that need 45 minutes or more of video. No, I think it's great. Nicole, thank you for facilitating this. I look forward to part two of Bill whenever he returns. until next time, and until Bill comes back, if people listen to this conversation, Nicole, think what they heard is worth having maybe a further conversation with you or your colleagues. What's the best way for them to get a hold of you and reach out?
Yeah, the best way is probably through our website, myprivatevista.com. On our homepage, there's a contact us button. You can put in your contact info, reference this episode, and then either myself or one of my wonderful colleagues will reach out to have a conversation, see what's on your mind. And I do want to say, just see, how does this all apply to you? Because each person is unique, and certainly each investor is unique. So we might all be experiencing what's going on, but how it impacts or how you may or may not want to react is going to be personalized to you.
Yeah, well said. Well said. The other thing you could do if you're listening to this podcast for the first time and you're not a subscriber is become one. And all you have to do is hit the follow button.
Yes.
That way, when new episodes of the podcast are dropped, you can give them a listen as well. I would also ask that if you like the podcast, tell people about it. Word of mouth promotion, it's a good thing. We'd appreciate it. So until next time, on behalf of Nicole and everybody at My Private Vista, I'm Bill Tucker, thanking you for taking the time to listen today. We'll catch you next time.
thank you for listening to the Dollars and Cents, Creating Your Fulfilled Life with Nicole Romito, sponsored by Private Vista. Visit our website at www.myprivatevista.com or give us a call at 312-831-4370. And don't forget to click the follow button to be notified when new episodes become available. Private Vista is a group comprised of investment professionals registered with Hightower Advisors LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. Advisory services are offered through Hightower Advisors LLC. This is not an offer to buy or sell securities. No investment process is free of risk, and there is no guarantee that the investment process or the investment opportunities referenced herein will be profitable. Past performance is neither indicative nor a guarantee of future results. The investment opportunities referenced herein may not be suitable for all investors. All data or other information referenced herein is from sources believed to be reliable. Any opinions, news, research, analyses, prices, or other data or information contained in this presentation is provided as general market commentary and does not constitute investment advice. Private Vista and Hightower Advisors, LLC, or any of its affiliates make no representations or warranties expressed or implied as to the accuracy or completeness of the information or for statements or errors or omissions, or results obtained from the use of this information. Private Vista and Hightower Advisors, LLC assume no liability for action made or taken in reliance on or relating in any way to this information. The information is provided as of the date referenced. Such data and other information are subject to changes without notice. This was created for informational purposes only. The opinions expressed herein are solely those of the authors and do not represent those of Hightower Advisors, LLC, or any of its affiliates.